wore a subdued navy blue suit, a neutral expression, and used a public library voice. John Daggett was laid out in meditation, which was just down the corridor and to my left. The family, he murmured, was in the Sunrise Chapel if I cared to wait. I signed in. Mr. Sharonson removed himself discreetly, and I was left to do as I pleased. The room was rimmed with chairs, the casket at the apex. There were two sprays of white gladioli that looked somehow like pristine fakes provided by the mortuary, instead of wreaths sent by those who mourned Daggett's passing. Organ music was being piped in, a nearly subliminal auditory cue meant to trigger thoughts about the brevity of life. I tiptoed across the room to have a peek at him. The color and texture of Daggett's skin looked about like a Betsy Wetsy doll I'd had as a kid. His features had a flattened appearance, which I suspected was a side effect of the autopsy process. Peel somebody's face back, and it's hard to line it all up again. Daggett's nose looked crooked, like a pillowcase put on with the seam slightly skewed. I was aware of a rustling behind me, and Barbara Daggett appeared on my right. We stood together for a moment without a word. I don't know why people stand and study the dead that way. It makes about as much sense as paying homage to the cardboard box your favorite shoes once came in. Finally, she murmured something and turned away, moving toward the entrance where Eugene Nickerson and Essie Daggett were just coming in through the archway. Essie was wearing a dark navy dress of rayon jersey, her massive arms dimpled with pale flesh. Her hair looked freshly done, puffed and thick, sprayed into a turban of undulating gray. Eugene, in a dark suit, steered her by the elbow, working her arm as if it were the rudder of a ship. She took one look at the casket, and her wide knees buckled. Barbara and Eugene caught her before she actually hit the floor. They guided her to an upholstered chair and lowered her into the seat. She fumbled for a handkerchief, which she pressed to her mouth as if she meant to chloroform herself.
"Sweet Jesus, Lord," she mewed, her eyes turned up piteously. "Lamb of God."
Eugene began to pat at her hand, and Barbara sat down beside her, putting one arm around her protectively.
"You want me to bring her some water?" I asked.
Barbara nodded, and I moved toward the doorway. Mr. Sharonson had sensed the disturbance and had appeared, his face forming a question. I passed the request along, and he nodded. He left the room, and I returned to Mrs. Daggett's side. She was having a pretty good time by now, rolling her head back and forth, reciting scriptures in a high-pitched voice. Barbara and Eugene were working to restrain her, and I gathered that Essie had expressed a strong desire to fling herself into the coffin with her beloved. I might have given her a boost myself. Mr. Sharonson returned with a paper envelope full of water, which Barbara took, holding it to Essie's lips. She jerked her head back, unwilling to accept even this small measure of solace.
"By night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loveth," she warbled. "I sought him that I found him not. I will rise now and go about the city in the streets, and in the broad ways I will seek him whom my soul loveth. The watchmen that go about the city found me. Lord in heaven, O God!"
With surprise I realized she was quoting fragments from the Song of Solomon, which I recognized from my old Methodist Sunday school days. Little kids were never allowed to read that part of the Bible, as it was considered too smutty. But I was real interested in the idea of a man with legs like pillars of marble set upon sockets of fine gold. There was some talk of swords and thighs that caught my attention, too. I believe I lasted 3 Sundays before my aunt was asked to take me down the street to the Presbyterians. Essie was rapidly losing control, whipping herself into such an agitated state that Eugene and Mr. Sharonson had to assist her to her feet and help her out of the room. I could hear her cries becoming feebler as she was moved down the hall. Barbara rubbed her face wearily.
"Oh, God, count on Mother," she said. "How has your day been?"
I sat down beside her. "This doesn't seem like the best time to talk," I said.
"Oh, don't worry about it. She'll calm down. This is the first she's seen of him. There's some kind of lounge upstairs. She can rest for a while, and she'll be fine. What about Ramona Westfall? Did you talk to her?"
I filled her in on my brief interview, bringing the subject around to my real question at this point, which had to do with the 2 other victims in the accident. Barbara closed her eyes, the matter clearly causing her pain.
"One was a little friend of Hillary Gahan's. Her name was Megan Smith. I'm sure her parents are still in the area. I'll check the address and telephone number when I get home. Her father's name is Wayne. I forget the name of the street, but it's probably listed. I took my notebook out and jotted the name down. And the fifth? Some kid who'd bummed a ride with them. They picked him up at the on-ramp to the freeway to give him a lift into town.
What was his name?
Doug Polakowski.
I stared at her. You're kidding.
Why, do you know him?
Polakowski is Billy Polo's real last name. It's on his rap sheet.
You think they're related?
They'd almost have to be. There's only one Polakowski family in town. It's got to be a cousin or a brother, something.
But I thought Billy Polo was supposed to be Daddy's best friend. That doesn't make sense.
Mr. Sharonson returned to the room and caught her eye.
Your mother is asking for you, Miss Daggett.
You go ahead, I said. I've got plenty to work on at this point. I'll call you later at home.
Barbara followed Mr. Sharonson while I headed out to the foyer and hustled up a telephone book. Wayne and Marilyn Smith were listed on Tupelo Drive out in Colgate, right around the corner from Stanley Place, if my memory served me correctly. I considered calling first, but I was curious what the reaction would be to the fact of Daggett's death, if the news hadn't already reached them. I stopped to get gas in the VW and then headed out to the freeway. The Smiths' house was the single odd one in a 12-block radius of identical tract homes, and I guessed that theirs was the original farmhouse at the heart of what had once been a citrus grove. I could still spot orange trees in irregular rows, broken up now by winding roads, fenced lots, and an elementary school. The Smiths' mailbox was a small replica of the house, and the street number was gouged out of a thick plank of pine, stained dark, and hung above the porch steps. The house itself was a two-story white frame with tall, narrow windows and a slate roof. A sprawling vegetable garden stretched out behind the house, with the garage beyond that. A tire swing hung by a rope from a sycamore that grew in the yard. Orange trees extended on all sides, looking twisted and barren, their producing years long past. It was probably cheaper to leave them there than to tear them out. An assortment of boys' bicycles in a rack on the porch suggested the presence of male offspring or an in-progress meeting of a cycling club. The bell consisted of a metal twist in the middle of the door. I cranked it once, and it trilled harshly. As with the Christopher house, the upper portion of the door was glass, allowing me a glimpse of the interior. High ceilings, waxed pine floors, a scattering of rag rugs, and early American antiques that looked authentic to my untrained eye. The walls were covered with patchwork quilts, the colors washed out to pale shades of mauve and blue. Numerous children's jackets hung from a row of pegs to the left, rain boots lined up underneath. A woman in jeans and an oversized white shirt trotted down the stairs, trailing one hand along the banister. She gave me a quick smile and opened the front door.
"Oh, hi. Are you Larry's mom?"
She read instantly from my expression that I hadn't the faintest idea what she was talking about. She gave a quick laugh.
"I guess not. The boys got back from the movie half an hour ago, and we've been waiting for Larry's mother to pick him up. Sorry."
"That's all right. I'm Kinsey Milhone," I said. "I'm a private investigator here in town." I handed her my card.
"Can I help you with something?"
She was in her mid-30s, her blonde hair pulled straight back from her face in a clumsy knot. She was dark-eyed, with the tanned good looks of someone who works outdoors. I imagined her to be the kind of mother who forbade her children to eat refined sugar and supervised the television shows they watched. Whether such vigilance pays off or not, I'm never sure. I tend to place kids in a class with dogs, preferring the quiet, the smart, and the well-trained.
"John Daggett was killed here in town Friday night," I said.
Something flickered across her face, but maybe it was just the realization that a painful subject was coming up again.
"I hadn't heard about that. What happened?"
"He fell out of a boat and drowned." She thought about that briefly.
"Well, that's not too bad. Drowning's supposed to be fairly easy, isn't it?"
Her tone of voice was light, her expression pleasant. It took me a minute to realize the savagery of the sentiment. I wondered what kind of torture she'd wished on him.
"Most of us don't get to choose our death," I said. "My daughter certainly didn't," she said tartly. "Was it an accident, or did someone give him a nice push?"
"That's what I'm trying to find out," I said. I heard he came up from L.A. on Monday, but nobody seems to know where he spent the week.
Not here, I can assure you. If Wayne so much as set eyes on him, he'd have...
The words tapered off to a faint smile, and her tone became almost bantering.
I was going to say he'd have killed him, but I didn't mean that literally.
Or maybe I did. I guess I shouldn't speak for Wayne.
What about you?
When did you see him last?
I have no idea. 2 years ago, at least.
At the trial?
She shook her head.
I wasn't there. Wayne sat in for a day, but he couldn't take it after that. He talked to Barbara Daggett once, I think, but I'm sure there's been nothing since.
I'm assuming somehow that the man was murdered. Is that what you're getting at?
It's possible. The police don't seem to think so, but I'm hoping they'll revise their opinion if I can come up with some evidence. I get the impression a lot of people wanted Daggett dead.
Well, I sure did. I'm thrilled to hear the news. Somebody should have killed him at birth, she said. Would you like to come in? I don't know what I can tell you, but we might as well be comfortable.
She glanced at my business card again, double-checking the name and then tucking it in her shirt pocket. She held the door, and I passed over the threshold, pausing to see where she meant for us to go. She led me into the living room.
You and your husband were home Friday night?
Why, are we suspects?
There isn't even a formal investigation yet, I said.
I was here. Wayne was working late. He's a CPA. She indicated a chair, and I sat down. She took a seat on the couch, her manner relaxed. She was wearing a thin gold bracelet on her right wrist, and she began to turn that, straightening a kink in the chain.
Did you ever meet John Daggett yourself? She asked.
Once. He came to my office a week ago Saturday.
Ah, out on parole, no doubt. He must have served his 10 minutes.
I made no comment, so she went on.
What was he doing in Santa Teresa, returning to the scene of the slaughter?
He was trying to locate Tony Gahan. This seemed to amuse her.
To what end? It's probably none of my business, but I'm curious.
I was discomfited by her attitude, which seemed an odd mix of the wrathful and the jocular.
I'm not really sure what his intentions were, I said carefully. The story he told me wasn't true anyway, so it's probably not worth repeating. I gathered he wanted to make restitution.
Her smile faded, dark eyes boring into mine with a look that chilled me.
There's no such thing as restitution for what that man did. Megan died horribly. 5 and a half years old. Has anyone given you the details?
I have the newspaper clippings in the car. I talked to Ramona Westfall, too, and she filled me in, I said, lying through my teeth. I didn't want to hear about Megan's death. I didn't think I could bear it, whatever it was.
Have you kept in touch with the other families?
For a moment, I didn't think I could distract her. She was going to sit there and tell me some blood-curdling tale that I was never going to forget. Cruel images seemed to play across her face. She faltered, and her expression underwent that transformation that precedes tears. Her nose reddening, mouth changing shape, lines drawing down on either side. Then her self-control descended, and she looked at me with clouded eyes.
I'm sorry. What?
I was wondering if you'd talked to the others recently, Mrs. Westfall or the Polakowskis.
I've hardly even talked to Wayne. Megan's death has just about done us in.
What about your other children? How are they handling it?
Better than we are, certainly. People always say, well, you still have the boys, but it doesn't work that way. It's not like you can substitute one child for another.
Belatedly, she took out a Kleenex and blew her nose.
I'm sorry I had to bring it all up again, I said. I've never had children, but I can't imagine anything more painful than losing one.
Her smile returned, fleeting and bitter.
I tell you what's worse, knowing there's a man out there doing a few months in jail for vehicular manslaughter when he murdered 5 people. Do you know how many times he got picked up for drunk driving before that accident? 15. He paid a few fines. He got his hand smacked. Once he did 30 days, but most of the time...
She broke off, then changed her tone.
Oh, hell. What difference does it make? Nothing changes anyway, and it never ends. I'll tell Wayne you stopped by. Maybe he knows where Daggett was.
Chapter 12. I sat in the car and shuddered. I couldn't think when an interview had made me feel so tense. Daggett had to have been murdered. I just didn't see how it could come down to any other way. What I couldn't figure out was how to get my thinking straight.
Usually the morality of homicide seems clear to me. Whatever the shortcomings of the victim, murder is wrong, and the penalties levied against the perpetrator had better be substantial to balance out the gravity of the crime. In this case, that seemed like a simplistic point of view. It was Daggett who had caused the world to tilt on its axis. Because of him, 5 people had died, so that his death, whatever the instrument, was swinging the planet upright again, restoring a moral order of sorts. At the moment, I still didn't know whether his desire to make restitution was sincere or part of some elaborate con. All I knew was that I'd been caught up in the loop and I had a part to play, though I had no idea yet what it was. I started the car and headed back to my place. The sky was clouding over again. It was after 5 o'clock, and a premature twilight already seemed to be spilling down the mountainside. I pulled up in front of my apartment and switched off the ignition. I glanced over at my windows, which were dark. I was feeling edgy, and I wasn't ready to go home yet. On impulse, I started the car again and headed for the beach, drawn by the scent of salt in the air. Maybe a walk would ease my restlessness. I pulled into one of the municipal lots and parked, slipping out of my shoes and pantyhose, which I tossed in the back seat along with my handbag. I zipped up my windbreaker and locked the car, tucking my keys in my jacket pocket as I crossed the bike path to the beach. The ocean was silver, but the breaking waves were a muddy brown, and the sand along the surf line was peppered with rocks. This was the winter beach, dark boulders having surfaced with the shifting coastal sands. Gulls hovered overhead, eyeing the thundering waves for signs of edible sea life. I walked along the wet sand with a buffeting wind at my back. A windsurfer clung to the crossbar on a bright green sail, arching himself against the force of the wind, his board streaking toward the beach. 2 big fishing boats were chugging into the marina. Everywhere there was the sense of urgency and threat. The torn white of storm surf, the darkening gray of the sky. Across the harbor, the ocean drove at the shore without pity, pounding at the breakwater with a grudging monotony. A rocketing spray shot straight up on impact, fanning along the sea wall. I could almost hear the splats as successive waves hit the concrete walkway on the landward side. I passed the entrance to the wharf. Ahead, the beach widened, curving left toward the marina where the bare masts of sailboats tilted in the wind like metronomes. The sand was softer here, deeper, too, so that walking became a labor. I turned and walked backwards for a few steps, trying to get my bearings. Somewhere along this part of the beach was the spot where Daggett's body had been found. A brief glimpse of the site had appeared on the newscast, and I was hoping now to get a fix on the place. I thought it was probably this side of the boat launch. Ahead and to my right was the kiddie park with its playground equipment and a fenced-in area with a wading pool. The newscast had shown a portion of the dredge in the background, intersected by the breakwater and a line of rocks. I trudged on until I had the 3 lined up in the same configuration. The dry sand was trampled, and there were signs that vehicles had crossed the beach. Where waves slapped against the shore, all traces of activity had been erased. The crime scene investigators had no doubt done at least a cursory search. I scanned the area without any expectation of finding evidence. If you murder a man by tossing him, dead drunk, out of a rowboat, there aren't any telltale clues to dispose of afterward. The boat itself must have been left adrift, and from what Jonas said, must have washed ashore closer to the pier. I drank in the heady perfume of the sea, watching the restless surge of the waves, turning myself slowly until the ocean was at my back and I was staring at the line of motels across the boulevard. Daggett had apparently died sometime between midnight and 5 o'clock a.m. I wondered if it would be productive to canvass the neighborhood for witnesses. It was possible, of course, that Daggett had actually cut the line on the skiff himself, rowing out of the harbor alone. With a 0.35 blood alcohol level, it seemed unlikely. By the time blood alcohol concentrations reach 0.40%, a drunk is essentially in a state of deep anesthesia, incapable of anything so athletic as working an oar. He might have maneuvered his way out of the harbor first and then sat in the bobbing boat, drinking himself insensible. But I couldn't picture that. I kept visualizing somebody with him, waiting, watching, finally hefting his feet and toppling him backwards. "A lesson in the backflip, Daggett. Oh, shit, you blew it. Too bad, sucker, you die."
Getting him in the boat in the first place might have been a trick, as drunk as he was, but the rest of it must have been a snap. I glanced to my right. An old bum with a shopping cart was picking through a trash container. I crossed the sand, heading toward him. As I approached, I could see that his skin was nearly gray with accumulated filth, tanned by the wind, with an overlay of rosiness from recent sunburn or Mogan David wine. Mad Dog 2020, as it's better known among the scruffy drifters. He looked in his 70s and was bulked up by layers of clothing. He wore a watch cap, his gray hair hanging out of it like mop strings. He smelled as musky as an old buffalo. The odor radiated from his body in nearly visible wavy lines, like a cartoon rendition of a skunk. "Hello," I said. He went about his business, ignoring me. He pulled out a pair of spike heels, inspecting them briefly before he tucked them into one of his plastic trash bags. A 2-day-old newspaper didn't interest him. Beer cans? Yes, he seemed to like those. A Kentucky Fried Chicken barrel was a reject. A skirt? He held it up with a critical eye and then shoved it into the trash bag with the shoes. Someone had discarded a plastic beach bowl with a hole punched in it. The old man set that aside. "Did you hear about the guy they found in the surf yesterday?" I asked. No response. I felt like an apparition calling to him from the netherworld. I raised my voice. "I heard somebody down here spotted him and called the cops. Do you happen to know who?" I guess he didn't care to discuss it. He resolutely avoided eye contact. I didn't have my handbag with me, so I didn't have a business card or even a dollar bill as a letter of reference. I had no choice but to let it drop. I moved away. By then he had worked his way down in the bin, his head almost out of sight. So much for my interviewing techniques. By the time I got back to the parking lot, the light had faded, so I registered the fact that something was wrong long before I realized what it was. The door on the passenger side of my car was ajar. I stopped in my tracks. "Oh, no," I said. I approached with caution, as if the vehicle might be booby-trapped. It looked like someone had run a coat hanger in through the wind wing in an attempt to jimmy the lock. Failing that, the shitheel had simply smashed the window out on the passenger side and had opened the door. The glove compartment hung open, the contents spilling out across the front seat. My handbag was missing. That generated a flash of irritation, swiftly followed by dread. I jerked the seat forward and hauled out my briefcase. The strap that secured the opening had been cut, and my gun was gone. "Oh, no," I wailed. I gave vent to a string of expletives. In high school, I had hung out with some badass boys who taught me to cuss to perfection. I tried some combinations I hadn't thought of in years. I was mad at myself for leaving the stuff in plain sight on the seat, and mad at the jerk who ripped me off. Mine was one of the last cars left in the lot and had probably stood out like a beacon. I slammed the car door shut and headed off across the street, still barefoot, gesturing and muttering to myself like a mental case. I didn't even have the spare change to call the cops. There was a hamburger stand close by, and I conned the fry cook into making the call for me. Then I went back and waited until the black and white arrived. The beat officers, Pettigrew and Gutierrez, Gerald and Maria, respectively, I'd encountered some months before when they made an arrest in my neighborhood. She took the report now while he made sympathetic noises. Somehow the two of them managed to console me insofar as that was possible, calling for a crime scene investigator who obligingly came out and dusted for prints. We all knew it was pointless, but it made me feel better. Pettigrew said he'd check the computer for the serial number on my gun, which was registered, thank God. Maybe it would turn up later in a pawn shop and I'd get it back. I love my little semi-automatic, which I've had for years. A gift from the aunt who raised me after my parents' death. That gun was my legacy, representing the odd bond between us. She'd taught me to shoot when I was 8. She had never married, never had children of her own. With me, she'd exercised her many odd notions about the formation of female character. Firing a handgun, she felt, would teach me to appreciate both safety and accuracy. It would also help me develop good hand-eye coordination, which she thought was useful. She'd taught me to knit and crochet so that I'd learn patience and an eye for detail. She'd refused to teach me to cook as she felt it was boring and would only make me fat. Cussing was okay around the house, though we were expected to monitor our language in the company of those who might take offense. Exercise was important. Fashion was not. Reading was essential, Two out of three illnesses would cure themselves, said she, so doctors could generally be ignored except in case of accident. On the other hand, there was no excuse for having bad teeth, though she viewed dentists as the persons who came up with ludicrous schemes for the human mouth. Drilling out all of your old fillings and replacing them with gold was one. She had dozens of these precepts, and most are still with me. Rule number one, first and foremost, above and beyond all else, was financial independence. A woman should never, never, never be financially dependent on anyone, especially a man, because the minute you were dependent, you could be abused. Financially dependent persons, the young, the old, the indigent, were inevitably treated badly and had no recourse. A woman should always have recourse. My aunt believed that every woman should develop marketable skills, and the more money she was paid for them, the better. Any feminine pursuit that did not have as its ultimate goal increased self-sufficiency could be disregarded. How to get your man didn't even appear on the list. When I was in high school, she'd called home ec home ick, and applauded when I got a D. She thought it would make a lot more sense if the boys took home ec and the girls took auto mechanics and woodshop. Make no mistake about it, she liked some men a lot, but she wasn't interested in tending to one like a charwoman or a nurse. She was nobody's mother, said she, not even mine, and she didn't intend to behave like one. All of which constitutes a long-winded account of why I wanted my gun back, but there it is. I didn't have to explain any of this to G. Pettigrew or M. Gutierrez. They both knew I'd been a cop for 2 years, and they both understood the value of a gun. By the time everyone left the parking lot, it was fully dark and starting to rain again. Oh, perfect. I drove home and started making out a list of items I'd have to replace, including my driver's license, gasoline charge card, checkbook, and God knows what else. While I was at it, I looked up 3-800 numbers, phoning in the loss of my credit cards from the Xerox copy I keep in my file drawer at home. I'd only been carrying about $20 in cash, but I resented the loss. It was all too irritating to contemplate for long. I showered, pulled on jeans, boots, and a sweater, and headed up to Rosie's for a bite to eat. Rosie's is the tavern in my neighborhood, run by herself, a Hungarian woman in her 60s, short and top-heavy, with dyed red hair that recently had looked like a cross between terracotta floor tile and canned pumpkin pie filling. Rosie is an autocrat, outspoken, overbearing, suspicious of strangers. She cooks like a dream when it suits her, but she usually wants to dictate what you should eat at any given meal. She's protective, sometimes generous, often irritating. Like your best friend's cranky grandmother, she's someone you endure for the sake of peace. I hang out at her establishment because it's unpretentious, and it's only half a block away from my place. Rosie apparently feels that my patronage entitles her to boss me around, which is generally true. That night when I walked in, she took one look at my face and poured me a glass of white wine from her personal supply. I moved to my favorite booth at the rear. The backs are high, cut from construction-grade plywood and stained dark, with side pieces shaped like the curve of a wing-back chair. Within moments, Rosie materialized at the table and set the glass of wine in front of me. "Somebody just busted out the window of my car and stole everything I hold dear, including my gun," I said. "I've got some shoshka levish for you," she announced. "And after that, you're gonna have a salad made with celery root, some chicken paprikash, some of Henry's good rolls, cabbage strudel, and deep-fried cherries if you're good and clean up your plate. It's on the house on account of your troubles. Only think about this one thing while you eat. If you had a good man in your life, this would never happen to you, and that's all I'm gonna say." I laughed for the first time in days. Chapter 13. The next morning, Monday, I began the laborious process of replacing the contents of my handbag. I hit the DMV first, since the offices opened at 8 o'clock a.m. I set in motion the paperwork for a new driver's license, paying $3 for a duplicate. The minute the bank opened, I closed out my checking account and opened a new one. I stopped by the apartment then and put a call through to Sacramento to the Bureau of Collection and Investigative Services, Department of Consumer Affairs, requesting application for a certified replacement for my private investigator's registration card. I armed myself with a batch of business cards from my ready supply and hunted up an old handbag to use until I could buy a new one. I drove over to the drugstore and made purchases to replace at least a few of the odds and ends I carry with me as a matter of course, birth control pills being one. At some point, I'd have to have my car window replaced, too. Irksome, all of it. I didn't reach the office until almost noon, and the message light on my answering machine was blinking insistently. I tossed the morning mail aside and punched the playback button as I passed the desk, listening to the caller as I opened the French doors to let in some fresh air.
Miss Milhone, this is Farron Westfall at 555-6790. My wife and I have discussed your request to speak with our nephew, Tony, and if you'll get in touch, we'll see what we can work out. Please understand, we don't want the boy upset. We trust you'll conduct whatever business you have with him discreetly.
There was a click, breaking the connection. His tone had been cold, perfectly suited to his formal, well-organized speaking voice. No uhs, no hesitations, no hiccups in the presentation. I lifted my brows appreciatively. Tony Gayen was in capable hands. Poor kid. I made myself a pot of coffee and waited until I'd downed half a cup before I returned the call. The phone rang twice. Good morning, PFC, the woman said. PFC turned out to be Perforated Formanek Corporation, a supplier of industrial abrasives, grinders, clamps, epoxy, cutters, end mills, and precision tools. I know this because I asked, and she recited the entire inventory in a sing-song tone, thinking perhaps that I was in the market for one of the above. I asked to speak to Farron Westfall and was thanked for my request. There was a click. Westfall, said he. I identified myself. There was a silence, meant, perhaps, to intimidate. I resisted the urge to rush in with a lot of unnecessary chatter, allowing the pause to go on for as long as it suited him. Finally, he said,
We'll see that Tony's available this evening between 7 and 8, if that's acceptable.
He gave me the address.
Fine, I said. Thank you.
Ass, I added mentally. Then I hung up. I tipped back in my swivel chair and propped my feet up. So far, it was a crummy day. I wanted my handbag back. I wanted my gun. I wanted to get on with life and quit wasting time with all this clerical nonsense. I glanced out at the balcony. At least it wasn't raining at the moment. I pulled the mail over and started going through it. Most of it was junk. I was feeling restless again, thinking about John Daggett and his boat trip across the harbor. Yesterday at the beach, the notion of canvassing the neighborhood for witnesses had seemed pointless. Now I wasn't so sure. Somebody might have seen him. Public drunkenness is usually conspicuous, especially at an hour when not many people are about. Weekend guests at the beach hotels had probably checked out by now, but it might still be worth a shot. I grabbed my jacket and my car keys, locked the office, and headed down the back stairs. My VW was looking worse every time I turned around. It's 14 years old, an oxidized beige model with dents. Now the window was smashed out on the passenger side. Not a class act by any stretch of the imagination, but it was paid for. Every time I think about a new car, it makes my stomach do a flip-flop. I don't want to be saddled with car payments, a jump in insurance premiums, and hefty registration fees. My current registration costs me $25 a year, which suits me just fine. I turned the ignition key, and the engine fired right up. I patted the dashboard and backed out of the space, taking State Street south toward the beach. I parked on Cabana, just across from the entrance to the wharf. There are 8 motels strung out along the boulevard, none with rooms for under $60 a night. This was the off-season, and there were still no vacancies. I started with the first, the Sea Voyager, where I identified myself to the manager, found out who'd been working the night desk the previous Friday, jotted down the name, and left my card with a handwritten note on the back. As with many other aspects of the job I do, this door-to-door inquiry requires dogged patience and a fondness for repetition that doesn't really come naturally. The effort has to be made, however, on the off chance that someone, somewhere, can fill in a detail that might help. Having worked my way to the last motel, I returned to my car and headed on down the boulevard toward the marina, half a mile away. I parked this time near the Naval Reserve Building in the lot adjacent to the harbor. There didn't seem to be much foot traffic in the area. The sky was overcast, the air heavy with the staunch smells of fresh fish and diesel fuel. I ambled along the walk that skirts the waterfront, with its 84 acres of slips for 1,100 boats. A wooden pier, 2 lanes wide, juts out into the water, topped with a crane and pulleys for hoisting boats. I could see the fuel dock and the city guest dock, where 2 men were securing the lines on a big power boat that they'd apparently just brought in. On my right, there was a row of waterfront businesses, a fish market with a seafood restaurant above, a shop selling marine and fishing supplies, a commercial diving center, 2 yacht brokers. The building fronts are all weathered gray wood with bright royal blue awnings that echo the blue canvas sail covers on boats all through the harbor. For a moment, I paused before a plate glass window, scanning the snapshots of boats for sale. Catamarans, luxury cabin cruisers, sailboats designed to sleep 6. There's a small population of liveaboards in the harbor, people who actually use their boats as a primary residence. The idea is mildly appealing to me, though I wonder about the reality of chemical toilets in the dead of night and showering in marina restrooms. I crossed the walk and leaned on the iron railing, looking out across the airy forest of bare boat masts. The water itself was a dark hunter green. Big rocks were submerged in the gloomy depths, looking like sunken ruins. Few fish were visible. I spotted 2 little crabs scuttling along the boulders at the water's edge, but for the most part the shallows seemed cold and sterile, empty of sea life. A beer bottle rested on a shelf of sand and mud. 2 harbor patrol boats were moored not far away. I spotted a line of skiffs tied up at one of the docks below, and my interest perked up. 4 of the marinas were kept locked and can only be entered with a card key issued by the harbor master's office, but this one was accessible to the public. I moved down the ramp for a closer look. There were maybe 25 small skiffs, wood and fiberglass, most of them 8 to 10 feet long. I had no way of knowing if one of these was the boat Daggett had taken, but this much seemed clear. If you cut the line on one of these boats, you'd have to row it out around the end of the dock and through the harbor. There was no current here, and a boat left adrift would simply bump aimlessly against the pilings without going any place. I went up the ramp again and turned left along the walkway until I reached Marina 1. At the bottom of the ramp, I could see the chain-link fence and locked gate. I loitered on the walk, keeping an eye on passers-by. Finally, a middle-aged man approached, his card key in one hand, a bag of groceries in the other. He was trim and muscular, tanned to the color of rawhide. He wore Bermuda shorts, topsiders, and a loose cotton sweater, a mat of graying chest hairs visible in the V. "Excuse me," I said. "Do you live down there?" He paused, looking at me with curiosity. "Yes." His face was as lined as a crumpled brown grocery bag pressed into service again. "Do you mind if I follow you out onto Marina 1? I'm trying to get a line on the man who washed up on the beach Saturday." "Sure, come on. I heard about that. The skiff he stole belongs to a friend of mine. By the way, I'm Aaron. You are?"
"Kinsey Milhone," I said, trotting down the ramp after him. "How long have you lived down here?"
6 months. My wife and I split up and she kept the house. Nice change, boat life. Lot of nice people. You a cop?"
"Private investigator," I said. "What sort of work do you do?"
"Real estate," he said.
"How'd you get into it?"
He inserted his card and pushed the gate open. He held it while I passed through. I paused on the other side so he could lead the way.
"I was hired by the dead man's daughter," I said.
"I meant, how'd you get into investigative work?"
"Oh, I used to be a cop, but I didn't like it much. The law enforcement part of it was fine, but not the bureaucracy. Now I'm self-employed. I'm happier that way."
We passed a cloud of seagulls converging rapidly on an object bobbing in the water. The screeches from the birds were attracting gulls from 1/4 mile away, streaking through the air like missiles.
"Avocado," Aaron said idly. "The gulls love them." "This is me."
He had paused near a 37-foot twin-diesel trawler, a Chris-craft with a flying bridge. "God, it's a beautiful boat."
"You like it?" "I can sleep 8, he said, pleased.
He hopped down into the cockpit and turned, holding a hand out to me.
"Pop your boots off and you can come on aboard and take a look around. Want a drink?"
"I'd better not, thanks. I've got a lot of ground to cover yet. Is there any way you can introduce me to the guy whose skiff was stolen?"
Aaron shrugged.
"Can't help you there. He's out on a fishing boat all day. But I can give him your name and telephone number if you like. I think the police impounded the skiff, so if you want to see that, you better talk to them.
I didn't expect anything to come of it, but I thought I'd leave the door open just in case. I took out a business card, jotting down my home number on the back before I passed it on to him. "Have him give me a call if he knows anything," I said.
"I'll tell you who you might want to talk to. Go down here 6 slips and see if that guy's in. The Seascape is the name of the boat. His is Philip Rosen. He knows all the gossip down here. Maybe he can help."
"Thanks." The Seascape was a 24-foot flicker, a gaff-rigged sloop with a 20-foot mast, teak deck, and a fiberglass hull that mimicked wood. I tapped on the cabin roof, calling a hello toward the open doorway. Philip Rosen appeared, ducking his head as he came up from down below. His emerging was like a visual joke. He was one of the tallest men I'd seen, except on a basketball court. He was probably 6'10", and built on a grand scale. Big hands and feet, big head with a full head of red hair, a big face with red beard and mustache, bare-chested and barefoot. Except for the ragged blue jean cutoffs, he looked like a Viking reincarnated cruelly into a vessel unworthy of him. I introduced myself, mentioning that Aaron had suggested that I talk to him. I told him briefly what I wanted.
"Well, I didn't see them, but a friend of mine did. She was coming down here to meet me and passed him in the parking lot. Man and a woman. She said the old guy was drunk as a skunk, staggering all over the place. The little gal with him had a hell of a time trying to keep him upright."
"Do you have any idea what she looked like?"
"Nope. Dinah never said. I can give you her number, though, if you want to ask her about it yourself."
"I'd like that," I said. "What time was this?"
"I'd say 2:15. Dinah's a waitress over at the wharf, and she gets off at 2. I know she didn't close up that night, and it only takes 5 minutes to get here. Shoot, if she walked on water, she could skip across the harbor in the time it takes her to get to the parking lot."
"Is she at work now, by any chance?"
"Monday afternoon. Could be. I never heard what her schedule was this week, but you can always try. She'd be up in the cocktail lounge. A redhead. You can't miss her if she's there."
Which turned out to be true. I drove the half mile from the marina to the wharf, leaving my car with the valet who handles restaurant parking. Then I went up the outside staircase to the wooden deck above. Dinah was crossing from the bar to a table in the corner, balancing a tray of margaritas. Her hair was more orange than red, too carroty a shade to be anything but natural. She was probably 6 feet tall in heels, wearing dark mesh hose and a navy blue sailor suit with a skirt that skimmed her crotch. She had a little sailor cap pinned to her head, and an air about her that suggested she'd known starboard from port since the day she reached puberty. I waited until she'd served the drinks and was on her way back to the bar. "Dinah?" She looked at me quizzically. Up close, I could see the overlay of pale red freckles on her face and a long, narrow nose. She wore false eyelashes, like a series of commas encircling her pale hazel eyes, lending her a look of startlement. I gave her a brief rundown, patiently repeating myself. "I know who the old guy is," I said. "What I'm trying to get a fix on is the woman he was with." Dinah shrugged. "Well, I can't tell you much. I just saw them as I went past. I mean, the marina's got some lights, but not that great. Plus, it was raining like a son of a bitch." "How old would you say she was?"
"On the young side. 20s, maybe. Blonde. Not real big, at least compared to him."
"Long hair, short, buxom, flat-chested?"
"The build, I don't know. She was wearing a raincoat, some kind of coat anyway. Hair was maybe shoulder-length, not a lot of curl. Kind of bushy."
"Pretty?" She thought briefly.
"God, all I remember thinking was there was something off, you know? For starters, he was such a mess. I could smell him 10 feet away. Bourbon fumes. Phew! Actually, I kind of thought she might be a hooker on the verge of rolling him. I nearly said something to her, but then I decided it was none of my business. He was having a great old time, but you know how it is. Drunk as he was, she really could have ripped him off."
"Yeah, well, she did. Dead is about as ripped off as you can get." Chapter 14. By the time I pulled out of the restaurant parking lot, it was 2 o'clock, and the air felt dank. Or maybe it was only the shadowy image of Daggett's companion that chilled me. I'd been half convinced there was someone with him that night, and now I had confirmation.
Not proof of murder, surely, but some sense of the events leading up to his death. A tantalizing glimpse of his consort, that other whose ghostly passage I tracked. From Dinah's description, Lavella Daggett was the first name that popped into my head. Her trashy blonde looks had made me think she was hooking when I met her in L.A. On the other hand, most of the women I'd run across to date were on the young side and fair-haired. Barbara Daggett, Billy Polo's sister Coral, Ramona Westfall, even Marilyn Smith, the mother of the other dead child. I'd have to start pinning people down as to their whereabouts the night of the murder. A tricky matter, as I had no way to coerce a reply. Cops have some leverage. A PI has none. In the meantime, I went by the bank and removed the cashier's check from my safe deposit box. I ducked into a coffee shop and grabbed a quick lunch, then spent the afternoon in the office catching up on paperwork. At 5 o'clock, I locked up and went home, puttering around until 6:30 when I left for Farron and Ramona Westfall's house to meet Tony Gahan. The Westfalls lived in an area called The Close, a dead-end street lined with live oaks over near the Natural History Museum. I drove through stone gates into the dim hush of privacy. There are only 8 homes on the cul-de-sac, all Victorian, completely restored, immaculately kept. The neighborhood looks even now like a small rural community, inexplicably lifted out of the past. The properties are surrounded by low walls of fieldstone, the lots overgrown with bamboo, pampas grass, and fern. It was fully dark by then, and the close was wreathed in mist. The vegetation was dense, intensely scented, and lush from the recent rain. There was only one street light, its pale globe obscured by the branches of a tree. I found the number I was looking for and parked on the street, picking my way up the path to the front. The house was a putty-colored one-story wood frame with a wide porch, white shutters and trim. The porch furniture was white wicker with cushions covered in a white and putty print. 2 Victorian wicker plant stands held massive Boston ferns. All too perfect for my taste. I rang the bell, refusing to peer in through the etched glass oval in the door. I suspected the interior was going to look like something out of House and Garden magazine, an elegant blend of the old, the new, and the offbeat. Of course, my perception was probably colored by Farron Westfall's curt treatment of me and Ramona's outright hostility. I'm not above holding grudges. Ramona Westfall came to the door and admitted me. I kept my tone pleasant, but I didn't fall all over myself admiring the place, which at a glance did appear to be flawlessly done. She showed me into the front parlor and removed herself, closing the oak-paneled sliding doors behind her. I waited, staring resolutely at the floor. I could hear murmuring in the hall. After a moment the door slid open and a man entered, introducing himself as Farron Westfall, as if I hadn't guessed. We shook hands. He was tall and slim, with a cold, handsome face and silver hair. His eyes were a dark green, as empty of warmth as the harbor. There were hints of something submerged in the depths, but no signs of life. He wore charcoal gray pants and a soft gray cashmere sweater that fairly begged to be stroked. He indicated that I should have a seat, which I did. He surveyed me for a moment, taking in the boots, the faded jeans, the wool sweater beginning to pill at the elbows. I was determined not to let his disapproval get through to me, but it required an effort on my part. I stared at him impassively and warded off his withering assessment by picturing him on the toilet with his knickers down around his ankles. Finally, he said,
"Tony will be out in a moment. Ramona's told me about the check. I wonder if I might examine it."
I removed the check from my jeans pocket and smoothed it out, passing it to him for his inspection. I wondered if he thought it was forged, stolen, or in some way counterfeit. He scrutinized it fore and aft and returned it, apparently satisfied that it was legitimate.
"Why did Mr. Daggett come to you with this?" he asked.
"I'm not really sure," I said. "He told me he tried to find Tony at an old address. When he had no luck, he asked me to track him down and deliver it."
"Do you know how he acquired the money?"
Again, I found myself feeling protective. It was really none of this man's business. He probably wanted to assure himself that Daggett hadn't come by the money through some tacky enterprise. Drugs, prostitutes, selling dogs and kitty cats to labs for medical experiments. "He won it at the track," I said. Personally, I hadn't quite believed this part of Daggett's tale, but I didn't mind if Farron Westfall got sucked in. He didn't seem any more convinced than I. He shifted the subject.
Would you prefer to be alone with Tony?
I was surprised at the offer.
Yes, I would.